You're listening to the WTA Insider Podcast. Ready? Play.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the WTA Insider Podcast. I'm Courtney Nguyen, senior writer for WTA Insider at WTATennis.com, and I'll be your host on this podcast, where we take you closer to the players and all the action on the WTA Tour. On this episode, we go through the new WTA Insider Heat Index rankings, which it's been a while since we've actually released a Heat Index, primarily because over the course of the clay season, it felt like the clay court power rankings, which are a much more analytical, empirical, numbers-based power ranking, you know, seemed to capture exactly what was happening on the tour during the clay court season, which was primarily led by the likes of Simona Halep, Elina Svitolina, Kristina Mladenovic, and then eventually, who knew, Yelena Ostapenko. But the reason why we're releasing the Heat Index this week is because as the tour transitions from, obviously, the hard court into the clay and now the clay into the grass, it felt like a good time to kind of step back a little bit and try to, and I have to say, this was a very tough set of rankings to put together because trying to make sense of what happened during the hard court season and what happened in the clay court season in an attempt to prognosticate what's going to happen in the upcoming grass court season, that was one Rubik's Cube, I have to say. So, but we're going to talk it out, and talking it out with me, as per usual, my conversation partner, my buddy, my WTA Insider cohort, the Robin to my failed Batman. It is David Kane, WTA web editor. David, who's coming to us from St. Petersburg, Florida, I believe. Hello, David. Welcome to the podcast.
Correct. The share to your sunny, Courtney. I am so happy to be here.
I am not that abusive. But let's jump right into this, David. So for the Heat Index, and we're recording this on Wednesday, June 21st. So it's the week of Birmingham and Mallorca. Basically, just to refresh people's memories, what is the WTA Insider Heat Index? The Heat Index looks to kind of identify the players who are hot right now. You know, sometimes with the WTA rankings, because they are based on a revolving 12-month schedule, a player could be ranked fairly high in the rankings, but those points that buoy that player's rankings may have been, you know, acquired 8 months ago, 9 months ago, 11 months ago. And so it might not be an indication as to, or their ranking, I should say, may not necessarily be an indication of where they are right now, you know, to the extent that they're slumping or struggling with their game or playing on a surface that they don't necessarily excel on. The Heat Index then tries to identify the players that are doing well right now, the most dangerous 12 players, I suppose, and then also factors in the upcoming, you know, 2 to 3 to 4 weeks. These are the players that we think are going to do well over the course of the next 4 weeks. And in this situation, we're looking at players who are about to play their grass season, start their grass season, or go into Wimbledon. So this is the only Heat Index ranking that we'll do before the conclusion of Wimbledon. We'll do another one after Wimbledon is complete as we head into the hard courts. So these rankings are completely subjective. David and I have gotten into very, very tough arguments. They don't escalate to Sonny and Cher style of arguments, but they are verbal and they are mean and they are cutting. But in terms of disagreeing a little bit. And there's harmonizing at times. In terms of disagreeing about where certain players are ranked, and that's the purpose of the podcast, is for David to basically tell me, Courtney, why my power rankings, my 1 through 12, are absolutely terrible. Basically. So without further ado, let's jump right into it. So the Heat Index rankings, as of right now, as of June 21st, according to Courtney, number one, I have Karolina Pliskova. Number two, Simona Halep. Number three, Elina Svitolina. Number four, Kristina Mladenovic. Number five, Venus Williams. Number six, Yelena Ostapenko. Number seven, Caroline Wozniacki. Number eight, Garbiñe Muguruza. Number nine, Johanna Konta. Number 10, Svetlana Kuznetsova. Number 11, Annette Kontaveit. And number 12, Anastasia Savastova. Now, this is the first time, and I'm not going to say it's the last time. It could continue to happen, but It bears emphasizing that of these 12 players, two of them come from the same country, and that country is Latvia, which, you know, kind of random. But I appreciated that as I was putting this list together. There's a couple of things that are the initial takeaways to me as I look at this list. One is number one and two. I kind of flipped the number one and twos on the current Porsche Race to Singapore. So according to the Porsche Race to Singapore, which only takes into consideration the points that have been earned in 2017, Simona Halep is actually at number one. So under the race rubric, she is the number one player in 2017. I personally have actually flipped that. I've put Pliskova at number one ahead of Halep. I will explain why in a little bit. And then also up here that may surprise some people, I've rated Garbiñe Muguruza fairly high at number eight, considering that she's outside of the top 10 right now. I've also put Annette Kontaveit, who is number 20 in the Porsche Race to Singapore. I've pushed her all the way up into the top 12 just because I think that she's been playing incredible tennis over the course of the last 2 months and is going to be an absolute threat on the grass. But let's start at the top with Pliskova and Halep. I just have been, I'm giving Pliskova an edge because of what she did in the first 3 months of the season. So while Halep obviously dominated the clay section, that Pliskova was able to do what she did in the first 3 months of the season on the hard courts, winning two titles in Brisbane and Doha, continually being in the final four of the biggest tournaments, final six, eight of the biggest tournaments, and then to then go into the clay and make the semifinals at the French Open, that's pretty bonkers to me. So I put her ahead of Halep, who really, I think, on the whole, struggled in the first 3 months of the season, but everything seemed to come together during the clay court season.
No, I agree. It's funny that you give Pliskova the edge based on the first 3 months. I actually give her much more of an edge because of how she performed on the clay courts specifically. I mean, I think if you were to tell me before the start of the clay court season, Halep's results and then Pliskova's results, I don't think Halep's would have been too much of a surprise, because we know what Halep can do on the clay, a former French Open finalist, the defending champion in Madrid. You know, injuries aside, she was certainly physically healthy in Miami. There were some questions of mental, emotional preparedness that she obviously answered in emphatic fashion, winning 19 matches on clay. But the way that Pliskova performed in Rome, the way she performed at the French Open, really just showing a level of consistency that mitigates prior surface liabilities, the way that she has just shown that she is a better player than her weaknesses at this point. And that is very impressive, particularly heading into a part of the season which should be especially fruitful for her, that being the grass court season. We haven't seen her play yet, but based on the way that she has been playing for the last 6 months, I think that we are going to see a lot more from her on the grass and at Wimbledon. So I have no problems with her at number one. You know, she's definitely a player that we could see perhaps be number one on all three ranking systems heading into the summer. So it's certainly an interesting prediction, to be sure.
Yes, that's a very good thing to point out, which is that Angelique Kerber, obviously, who doesn't feature in the power rankings at the moment, or the heat index rankings at the moment, simply because, as we know, she is in a bit of a slump coming out of the clay season. But she is the world number one at the moment. Pliskova and Halep, though, it's going to be a three-woman race over the course of the next few months, I suspect. I wouldn't surprise me if the number one ranking gets ping-ponged back and forth between those three, between Kerber, Pliskova, and Halep. Halep, in fact, had a chance this week to take over the number one ranking had she played Birmingham. And a certain, you know, combination of results happened, but she did pull out. So Angelique Kerber will go into Wimbledon as the number one seed, obviously a finalist there last year, and can play well on grass. So I'm not discounting her at all. But yeah, so that's kind of the Pliskova Halep switch. At number three, as I said, Alina Svitolina, just incredibly consistent. A bit disappointing, obviously, not being able to close out Halep and potentially put herself in a position to win her first Maiden Slam at the French Open, blowing that lead against Halep in the quarterfinals. But has played well, has played consistently, has fought incredibly well. Kristina Mladenovic, I think that you and I discussed this in our last podcast, David. You know, she really was the big story, or one of the big stories in Paris. She's one of the big stories of the first 6 months of the season, completely in terms of the way that she's been playing, how relevant she is. I think you and I have looked at, you know, or have been asked at different times to put together our list of like, oh, what are the best matches of the season? And she is one half of the cast in almost like 80% of them. I mean, she's just been part of all of the drama of the 2017 season. But, you know, all that being said, she has one title. Right. I mean, she's made finals. She's been up there. She's there and she's in the mix. But that's why I ended up putting her behind Svitolina, primarily for that reason, is because of the one title. And then at number five, Venus Williams, which may surprise people, may not. I don't know. In terms of putting her that high, obviously Australian Open finalist. I thought she played really well in both Rome and in Paris, losing in Rome to Muguruza, and then obviously doing well, but losing in three sets to Tomea Baczynski in Paris. But now we go into the grass court season. Seems like she could do some damage.
You'd think with those five Wimbledon titles.
I don't want to underrate her or anything, but you know.
Yeah, but looking at 3 to 5, it's an interesting range and probably one where you and I bump a little bit more. I mean, I think when we were starting to put the list together, seeing Mladenovic behind Svitolina, just given, as you said, her relevance and her impact, her influence, if you will, over the last 6 months on all surfaces, playing these incredible matches. Yes, not winning as many titles as Svitolina. It has been so impressive how Svitolina's managed to be so consistent to win 2 Premier 5s and win 2 international titles, 4 a tour leading 4 titles on 2 surfaces. But If you were to ask me who I thought had a better chance of doing well at Wimbledon, I think this is where you and I tend to deviate a little bit in our format. I think I'm a little bit more forward-looking rather than leaning too much on the past. I would think that Mladenovic has a better shot of doing well on the grass. She is already into the second round in Birmingham. She got a good win over Duan Yingying, playing some really aggressive tennis. In her first round, had a tough loss against Alessia Sorenko last week in Sertogenbosch. And obviously, I think that's what keeps me from fighting much harder, because it would, you know, that's obviously a tough loss. That's the second loss to Sorenko this year. It's really the one blip in Mladenovic's season since winning St. Petersburg, those 2 losses to the Ukrainian. But yeah, just very impressive on all surfaces, playing a really big game. Likes the grass, and so should do well, and should certainly have a good shot of making her first second week at Wimbledon. Neither Svitolina nor Mladenovic have done that yet, although Mladenovic has made the third round before. And then, yeah, Venus, I think there's an argument to be made that at the start of 2017, seeing Venus at number 5 on a sort of heat index, looking back on the most consistent players of the last 6 months, that she is probably the most surprising entrant on this list, just because of how up and down the last few seasons have been for her. And to see her take her hard court momentum, you know, and performed admirably at the French Open, beating some informed players in 2017, beating Wang Cheng, beating Elise Mertens, who lost to Svitolina in the Istanbul final and won her first title earlier in the year. You know, this is a really good part of the season now for Venus on grass, a surface that she certainly has succeeded on over the course of her career, and is looking healthy, has been playing consistent tennis. You know, what would be a more WTA, you know, response to a 20-year-old Ostapenko winning her first slam title than to have Venus Williams come back and win a 6th Wimbledon? You know, I think it would be one of those key stories that we would be looking back on and shrugging our shoulders, if not laughing a little bit at just the symmetry of it all. But yeah, certainly 3 through 5, I definitely agree with those being, you know, present, if not in that order exactly.
So I guess the next chunk we'll talk through are different players who are in very different stages of their season. They're not all doing well at the exact moment, but they're all showing signs of being particularly dangerous for the course of the next few weeks. And they are number 6 and French Open champion Yelena Ostapenko, number 7 Caroline Wozniacki, and number 8 Garbiñe Muguruza, and number 9 Johanna Konta. You know, with Ostapenko, you know, there's arguments to be made both ways, that whether or not she should be included in this list or not, simply because Yes, she won the French Open. Yes, she goes in the grass season hot. But has she shown consistent form throughout the season? Probably not. Is she the type of player who's going to show consistency over the course of a season? Probably not. So you're kind of gauging how hot the iron is with respect to Yelena Ostapenko and whether it can strike again. Caroline Wozniacki, I have her at 7 on the strength of, obviously, the fantastic first 3 months of the season that Wozniacki had, making back-to-back finals in the Middle East, in Doha and Dubai, making the Miami final as well, and playing, you know, pretty good tennis. And she played the best clay court match of her career, I think, to beat Svetlana Kuznetsova at the French Open and make the quarterfinals, where she eventually lost to Ostapenko. I think that she continues to be dangerous. I mean, grass, you never know with Caroline. But, you know, look, I completely wrote her off of the clay court season. And so I'm trying not to write her off this time. So long as she's healthy, I think that she's playing some pretty good tennis. At number 8, Garbiñe Muguruza, who now with her French Open ranking points dropping off is outside the top 10. But there was something about Muguruza's clay court season, particularly the last 2.5 weeks of it, making the semifinal in Rome and then making the fourth round of the French Open and losing that tough three-setter to Mladenovic. I was just generally impressed with the way that she was fighting. I thought the level that she actually brought in Paris was really good. And she came up and ran up against a player and a crowd that were on fire that given day. But I left Paris feeling far more positive about Muguruza's prospects, especially as a former finalist at Wimbledon. So she knows how to play on grass, or can play on grass at least, has proven it in the past. But I left feeling a bit better about her than I was even going into the French Open. And then at number 9, Johanna Konta, who I don't think has necessarily shown her grass court prowess all the time, but she's keen to learn. She's keen to try and figure out the surface. Made the final in Nottingham, losing to Donna Vekic, still in the tournament in Birmingham. So we'll see, but on the whole, probably a slightly disappointing clay court season for Konta, but it's hard to say that she really took any bad losses. I mean, she had some tough draws, you know, drawing Venus in Rome, drawing Ziegemund at a post-midnight match in Madrid. You know, so she had some tough ones. So that's kind of how I had 6 through 9. What do you think, David?
Yeah, I know you feel like you're high on Muguruza. I might actually have put her ahead of Wozniacki just on the strength of prior grass court prowess. Okay. You know, I feel like Muguruza, former Wimbledon finalist, did play a really impressive match against Elizaveta Golichkova in Birmingham, getting that done in three sets, and was feeling relieved to sort of be done with this chapter of her career after the French Open, a tournament in which she had probably one of the toughest draws in the first week, getting Francesca Schiavone, who was potentially playing her last French Open, an on-fire heat index debuting Anett Kontaveit in the second round, you know, former quarterfinalist Yulia Putintseva in the third round, and then having to play Mladenovic in the fourth. You know,
it's a brutal draw.
Certainly wasn't, you know, a throwaway performance from Muguruza. I think she definitely gave all she could against the opposition that she was up against. Definitely a tough one for her. And so maybe she comes away from that feeling positive, you know, that she gave her defense of her time, that she gave her title defense all that she could, and, you know, and is now looking forward to a new stretch of the season for her and on a surface that she's done well in the past. And so I might put her ahead of Wozniacki, who did not do great last year in the grass court, but she was coming back from injury at the time. She did lose actually to Kontaveit, to bring her up again, leading into
Wimbledon. Annette is everywhere.
We have made it to the other side of Annette. It's a full circle moment, really. And then losing in the first round of Wimbledon to Svetlana Kuznetsova, who has sort of been candid about her own prospects on the surface. You know, so it's, that's in, and her French Open run was certainly surprising. It wasn't the toughest draw heading into the fourth round. I think everyone would agree with that, but certainly made up for it against Kuznetsova in the fourth round. You know, with Ostapenko, I really do feel that there is an argument to be made that she was certainly trending upward, you know, at the start of the clay court season, had made the final in Charleston, semis of Prague, did get a little injured, I think, at that point, and then was still a player at that point, forced to play qualifying in Madrid and Rome. This is not something that she's going to have to run into now for the next year. I remember when Mirjana Lucic-Baroni made the semifinals of the Australian Open, one of the things she was most excited about was the fact that she wouldn't have to roll up to a tournament, you know, a few days early to have to play qualifying and then be a little bit tired heading into your first match. Obviously, as a 20-year-old, maybe fatigue shouldn't be an issue, but still, you know, it's nice to be a top seed heading into these tournaments from now on, not having to deal with that extra pressure of having to even get into the main draw of these big tournaments. And, you know, so much of the myth, the legend that is Yelena Ostapenko at this point has been this carefree confidence, you know, this joie de vivre, as it were, that she was just able to throw caution to the wind, to add another cliche to my list, and just play fantastic tennis. And so it's harder to look at her as being a prime candidate for sort of a mental letdown. You know, could she potentially go out at the first round of Wimbledon and hit, you know, 24 errors and be off the court in an hour? Potentially, you know, that is the game that she plays. And so that's possible. I do think we were seeing a more consistent Ostapenko on the clay throughout the clay court season. And if that's the sort of form that she brings to the grass, a surface on which she was able to demolish a then top 10 Carla Suarez Navarro in her maiden slam debut 2 years ago as a wild card. And then at that point reigning junior champion, there's no reason why she won't bring that same swagger and confidence to the All England club this year. She is heading to Eastbourne, so we'll get a chance to see her at least 1 week before the third major of the year, unless she pulls out, of course. But yeah, looking at that list, I think Konta's at a good place as well. I think I agree that, you know, that was a tough loss to Vekic. I think even the commentators, British though they were a little bit unimpressed with her evident lack of comfort with the surface and her movement. I think, you know, I think hard courts and Johanna Konta are pretty synonymous in terms of stability, consistency, and, you know, not getting any bad bounces, not having any slippery conditions. And so I think this is always going to be a difficult stretch of the season for Ryan. And I agree with the clay. It was sort of a bad stretch of draws that probably set her up for a tough loss to Sei Su Wei, even though that wasn't the toughest draw. She didn't have the sort of match experience that a Konta might have wanted heading into the French Open. So yeah, I think these are all players who could potentially do well at Wimbledon. I do think for the most part they're adequately ordered.
Adequately ordered. What a compliment.
Not easily handed out here at Insider Studios, but you got to take what you can get.
Boy, I don't know. I think you're the Sunny to my share, my friend. Interesting comment that you made about Konta that I just wanted to follow up on, because am I wrong, or does there seem to be this, I don't know if it's conscious or subconscious, but this assumption, I suppose, that British players are good on grass?
I guess it's just, I think it is sort of nationalistic based. I mean, we assume that Americans are going to do their best on hard courts. We assume that, I mean, when Jack Sock said that his favorite surface was clay, I think people are still like mopping their brains off the ground at the shock of a player not having their favorite surface be that of their country's origin. I mean, I think we assume the same of French players and clay. I do think it's sort of just an inherent nationalistic assumption that if you are born on the surface, growing up playing on it, it should be your best surface, or at least should be your most comfortable surface.
I definitely understand that with respect to the other three Grand Slam nations, because I think that it's probably true that hard courts are prevalent in the United States and in Australia, and there's probably more clay courts in France than there are in Australia and Britain and the US. So I get that, but I don't understand, I suppose, or I don't necessarily buy into this idea that if you're in Britain, that you grew up playing on grass courts.
Oh, see, I did kind of assume that.
Yeah, I don't think that that's right at all. I mean, I think that you grew up playing on hard courts. And
really?
And then there is this kind of idea. Now, that being said, having, you know, I've been in Dunblane, I've been around Scotland and Britain and seen some of the facilities and stuff. Some of the tennis clubs do have this kind of AstroTurf type of fake grass that does yield a low bounce, and so it kind of mimics a little bit the way that the grass plays, but not always. But even with that, it's not the same, and I'm not entirely sure that all the players would have had access to that as well. So it's that thing with grass. Almost that I always see, like, for example, with respect to people's expectations of a Sam Stosur, for example, at Grass, because the expectation, right, or the conventional wisdom with respect to a game that succeeds on grass is that you're a power player and you have a big serve. And if you have these two things, that you will, and that you're good at the net, I guess, arguably. And if you have this combination of three things, and you are going to succeed on grass courts. Now that, and therefore, people just can't understand why Sam Stosur can't make it past the third round at Wimbledon. Now, if you watch Sam Stosur play and you watch her stroke production, it absolutely makes sense because she needs a high ball. That the low, it's not about the surface, but it's the low bounce. That doesn't yield, that doesn't feed into her weapons. And also the fact that her best serve is a kick serve, which a kick serve on grass doesn't work because that ball just actually doesn't kick so much as it sits in a player's hitting zone because the bounce is lower. So it's a bit odd. And so all that is just to say, like when we talk about the Contas and the Watsons, and Laura Robson has said flat out that she likes playing on grass. So fair enough, junior Wimbledon champion and whatnot. But even Naomi Brody, who has a big serve, big forehand, she said today, this week in a press conference, like, I don't know why people think that I like grass. Like, that's absurd. You know, and she doesn't actually like it, and she's not particularly comfortable on it. And we just assume that there's a level of comfort that they have with it that I guess other countries don't have.
Yeah. I mean, and then also the wild cards that they received to Wimbledon. I mean, I guess you assume that your federation is going to try to give you a fighting chance of doing well at a tournament that you should do what that you like or that you should do well on. I mean, I think it's almost like it's almost a subtle implication that perhaps the Wimbledon wild cards are totally wasted, because you would at least hope that these players are comfortable playing on grass or at least looking forward to playing on grass. The Brody point is interesting because I would associate her serve as being one that would be more successful on grass. I mean, I can't imagine too many people are still wondering why Stosur is not a Wimbledon player. I mean, I think I was pretty quickly disabused of that notion when I saw Anna Ivanovic beat her in 2009. Cause I think I did come in with that same idea that, oh, her big serve.
I would hear it all the time though, with commentators and people really? Being like, well, but you know, especially because she would typically come into Wimbledon after doing well at the French Open. And somebody's like, well, if she had full of confidence from the French, then, you know, I was always like, no, it's not going to happen. I assure you. It's just, it's X's and O's. I promise you, it's X's and O's. Like, well, I don't understand why people aren't seeing this. Like, you cannot hit a topspin forehand the way that she hits it off of a low bouncing ball like that. You know, what Rafa's able to do off of it is astounding. And even Rafa hasn't been able to play that great at Wimbledon consistently.
Yeah, I think she came up around the same time as the old clay court myths started to get debunked. So I think we're all kind of learning together of like what succeeds, what can now succeed on clay. Cause I mean, we would never have thought that like an Anna Ivanovic, to bring her up again, could have won a French Open. Cause we think of someone who hits the ball that hard as not necessarily being a clay courter who could succeed on a slow surface. And yet now she's sort of ushered in this, you know, run of big hitting, powerful Yelena Ostapenko clay court players who can hit through the slow conditions. I will say, to bring it back to Konta, that at the start of her sort of surge in 2015, she did make the quarterfinals of Eastbourne, beating former born goat Yekaterina Makarova and eventual would-be Wimbledon finalist Garbine Muguruza en route to the quarterfinals, losing to eventual champion Belinda Bencic. But for the most part, her streak, the streak that she rode into the U.S. Open, was on outdoor hard courts.
Yep, exactly. And that was an impressive string of contifacts, by the way.
Yeah, well, I had a little help.
Fair point. Yeah, it's an interesting I do think that British players have more exposure to the grass.
And maybe that's what it is, because it's such a rare surface. You would automatically give ups to those who have actually been. I mean, there are some players who are playing their first. I mean, Cece Bellis this week played her first match on grass ever, you know, and then she's already what, 25?
Yeah. Have you ever played on grass? Like.
I have once or twice. I played once on the Tennis Hall of Fame courts. And then again, once out on, the eastern tip of Long Island.
Okay.
So it's
weird.
Not fun.
It's not fun. I mean, it's a very, I don't know if people really understand this, who've never actually played on it or stepped on it, or even just don't even play on it, just go and watch a ball bounce on it, like sit on the court and watch people play, it is a completely different game. And so it, again, to me, as much as people, I was thinking about this week watching a lot of the slips and falls of people playing on grass and some of the craziness of the points and, you know, players not running and sprinting through balls because they know that they can't get it or they're going to risk a fall, that it is far more alien of a surface than clay. As an American, though, I grew up kind of thinking that clay was the most alien. That it was like, you slide and it's weird and what? You play on clay? Like, what is this nonsense? I don't understand this, you know? So the clay season has always been a little bit more, at least in my head, and I think that in the heads of a lot of American players as well, that it's quite unique as a surface, but I find grass to be far more alien. I think that they're just things that you do on a hard court or a clay court that you simply cannot do on a grass court, and the way that you should play and the way that you should play to kind of maximize your skill sets and your weapons, it requires you to really like shift into a different mode.
Oh, completely. I mean, growing up, to bring up more Long Island tennis facts, I actually grew up a mile or so away from a long stretch of outdoor red clay, which is actually where they were trying to have that 125K in West Hempstead. Right. So I grew up a little bit on red clay, and then grass was certainly the more foreign surface because, like as I said, there were not any around. And it is interesting to hit on grass more than it is to actually play on grass, if that makes sense. Like, it's cool to serve on it because it gives your serve an extra pop, and it's cool to hit a winner on it because it kind of zips through the line. But to actually play rallies, you know, with a friend or even just to play a match, it's a whole list of variables that you're just not used to on any surface, and you just don't have the time. I mean, clay certainly slows things down, but at least you have a minute to actually consider what you're going to do with the ball, as opposed to grass, you're seeing it, you know, slide right past you and you don't really even know what's happening. I mean, certainly these players are a bit more experienced than I, so I will certainly give them more
just
credit heading into this grass court season.
Just a tick more experience. But yes, it's peculiar. It's a peculiar surface, I have to say. And the 5 weeks of the grass court season, I find to be fascinating because I think that it's the toughest transition from going to, you know, clay to grass. It's just a bit nuts. But yeah, all that is just to say, I don't know how well Joe Conte is going to do on the grass, but I just was trying to disavow people from the notion that she's going to do well at Wimbledon because she's British. That just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, no, if anything, that would, you would draw the opposite conclusion based on
that's true.
Based on that alone, just saying.
I hear you. But yeah, so turning to the last three players on the list, on the heat index, number 10, Svetlana Kuznetsova, number 11, the En Fuego, Annette Kontaveit, and number 12, the quiet assassin, Anastasia Sevastova. I mean, I just couldn't help but push Kontaveit up. You know, she's, like I said, she's number 20 in the race. She's outside the top 35 in the rankings, although hopefully she'll move up from that. Although I guess she's not in action this week. So she's at number 36 after winning her first WTA title at the Ricoh Open in Sertogenbosch, second final of the season, having made her first final of 2017 in Bilbien, where she lost to another En Fuego player that everyone should keep an eye on, Markéta Vondrousova. So I just feel like she's so dangerous. And I feel like she's the name these days that when I open up a draw, I automatically want to find out where is Annette Kontaveit. So I have her at number 11. And then number 12, Anastasia Sevastova, who some people might say, what? Really? Anastasia Sevastova? To which I say, yes, really, Anastasia Sevastova. Mm. She has had a quietly solid season. You know, she's soft-spoken and, you know, easy to kind of go under the radar, but she's currently ranked number 19 in the rankings, which already probably surprises a lot of people that she's a top 20 player. Has had a fantastic season, made the third round at the French Open, made the semifinals in Madrid, beating Kiki Bertens, beating Karolina Pliskova as well in Madrid. Zhang Shuai, she beat there as well. Made the quarterfinals in Stuttgart, where she beat Konta, where she beat Stozer, and lost to Simona Halep. Quarterfinals in Charleston, beating Petkovic and Jabeur, losing to Ziegemund, who a bunch of people were losing to Ziegemund that year, that week. And then semifinals in Dubai, where she beat Begu, Risk, Peng, and Wang, and then eventually lost to Caroline Wozniacki. So it's been a solid, you know, season for her, and it's really gone under the radar. She continues to just perform solidly, perform well, and I think that her game... which is really, you know, she has a lot of slice, has a great drop shot, good variety, not a ton of power, but can move the ball around really well. I think that it could do well on grass now that she has some actual confidence. So yeah, Anastasia Savastova rounding it out. So the last three, Kuznetsova, Kontaveit, Savastova. Thoughts, David?
Yeah, I mean, Kuznetsova, I think, is ranked where she should be and really only has herself to blame for it. I mean, I really think that she is probably the most unfortunate surprise. I don't want to say disappointment, but unfortunate surprise of the French Open, given the draw that she had, really an opportunity for her to have made, you know, perhaps a final, if not maybe even take a third Grand Slam title. You know, I think especially with the momentum that she took from the hard court season, making the finals at Indian Wells, I think I did expect a little bit more from her, but I think it is understandable hearing Sveta talk during the French Open, talking about the pressure that she feels, particularly at the French Open, the nerves that she feels, the extreme desire with which she wants to perform at that particular tournament. It is understandable to see that it doesn't always necessarily come together for her, and it's unfortunate because she does certainly have the game to succeed at that. At that event. And, you know, coming into grass, has made the quarterfinals of Wimbledon last year, beat Wozniacki and Root. So is not, you know, and won't be feeling too much pressure heading into this part of the season once again. So it would be interesting to see how she performs. And there really is no denying what Annette Kontaveit has done pretty much since Miami, you know, playing where she played Simona Halep and then ended up making the final in Biel-Bien, taking that form onto clay, beating Garbiñe Muguruza, playing two tough sets against Maria Sharapova in Stuttgart, you know, having Muguruza on the ropes again in Paris, and then doing what she did last week in Sertogenbosch, winning her first title. Really the definition of a surging player who certainly deserves our recognition for sure, and is definitely one we'll likely be unseeded heading into Wimbledon, which is unfortunate for the seeds, to be honest.
Exactly.
You know, it's really great to see what she's been able to do. She's already made a second week of a slam before at the U.S. Open back in 2015. So she is potentially a slam player. And so that is something good to see. And yes, for Savastova, I don't think anyone would have expected to see her defend or back up her run to the U.S. Open quarterfinals. If you can remember, she didn't make the U.S. Open quarterfinals last summer, beating Muguruza and Jo Konta along the way. And then turning her ankle very early into that match against Caroline Wozniacki, and so potentially could have continued that run even farther, but playing well on the hard courts, on the clay, had a tough loss to Petra Martic at the French Open, did think she could have potentially gone farther where she would have played Svitolina, and then is a former finalist last year in Mallorca on grass, so certainly a player who could do well at Wimbledon, has never won a match there before, but is certainly this is the new Anastasia Savastova of the last 2 years, the second career after taking some time off, briefly retiring from the sport. So a lot of the previous Wimbledon losses are from what feel like many moons ago. So yeah, certainly it's great to see her on the list because she's definitely the insideriest of the top 12 for sure.
I mean, speaking of insideriest, Latvia.
Yeah.
Yelena Ostapenko, Anastasia Savastova, Latvia is officially a tennis powerhouse.
Two very different players.
Totally different. And it's
kind of similar personalities in their own way, both very dry, short.
I suspect, you know, that's a very Latvian thing. I remember, you know, back when I was speaking to, like, you know, Ernest Gulbis on the men's side, who had been the last, you know, kind of Latvian to do mm-hmm. something awesome at a Grand Slam before Yelena Ostapenko came around. And but all three of them have a very similar dry, like not too wowed by anything.
Thoughtful in their own way.
Yeah, thoughtful in their own way. Michaela Maroney-esque, like, unimpressedness about everything. I mean, it's really refreshing. Like, I love talking to Svastova. And Ostapenko is just, you know, the whole time that you talk to her, you're just trying to figure out what's going on in that brain of hers. And it's great. And so, yeah, who knew? If you were to tell me at the beginning of the season that there would be a week where there were more Latvians in the WT Insider Heat Index than any other country, I think that might have been the most surprising thing, the most surprising prediction. I don't think I would have ever seen that coming.
Yeah, it would have been tough to imagine both of them playing this well at the same time. I think maybe one, but the fact that both of them have taken this form from hard courts to clay and now potentially to grass is. Come on, Russia, what are you doing?
Get it together, Russia. But David, are there any other players outside of the top 12 that you kind of have your eye on as being like, you know, I think that player could have a chance of kind of being there in the heat index, you know, after grass or irrespective of the heat index, somebody who's really, you know, soaring up your estimation as being a player who's going to be dangerous over the course of the grass season. Let her rip.
Yeah, we talked briefly about Marketa Vondrasheva, who's definitely on that list of surging players as broken to the top 100, French Open.
Exactly. Like, kind of break down for people who don't know about Marketa Vondrasheva, Czech player, break down kind of the cult of Marketa, because I feel like it's the bandwagon is getting real tight. It's getting real cozy. But I also at the same time feel like people don't know how special this is, this thing that we're watching.
It's really, it's been the story of the last few months, you know, ever since, you know, for years we've been talking about this rise of the veterans, the 30 pluses. But since, you know, Indian Wells, we've seen a really big rise of youth of 25 and unders. And certainly Vondrasheva, the youngest of all at 17, winning her first title as a qualifier in Biel-Bien, where she beat Kontaveit, you know, couldn't be nicer and talk about unimpressed, couldn't be more, you know, pleased with her success and sort of in awe of it and how she's been able to string together these wins, you know, won a 100K in Trnava heading into the French Open, where she blistered her way into the main draw, dropping, I think, 6 or 7 games and losing, unfortunately, to Daria Kasatkina in the second round, you know, rematch of a junior slam semifinal that they played back in 2014. Vondrasheva, certainly among those names that we're now seeing, Kasatkina, Ostapenko, Bencic, you know, a junior slam champion in doubles, had struggled with injury and is now coming back and just plays a really powerful game left-handed. It's just another addition to this, you know, really impressive Czech squad that, you know, just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And it's been a slow grow in terms of points because the points haven't come at the biggest tournaments, but when she's been getting these wins, they've been impressive. And it's again, another fearless, big hitting player that are really becoming the story of the 2017 season.
Most definitely. And so, yeah, if you get a chance, definitely tune in to Marketa Vondrasheva. She's kind of the next one. She's going to break through. I mean, she's working herself up the rankings. She was absolutely over the moon having qualified at the French Open, really humble, was just like, you know, in January, I was playing like 10Ks on the ITFs. And now I'm going to play a main draw at Roland Garros. Like, she kind of had this look of like, what the heck is going on? This is, my life is crazy right now. So, you know, which is really, really refreshing, really, really sweet to see. And so you have her, you know, 17-year-old who's making her way up. Cece Bellis, who's obviously playing incredibly well. I mean, 2-0 now in tour level matches on grass, having beaten Carla Suarez Navarro.
Look out, Venus.
Exactly. Watch it, Venus. You might not be the number one American on grass. But beat Carla Suarez Navarro in her opening round match in Mallorca, and then back that up with a good win over Mona Barthel, which those are two quality players, regardless of surface, for an 18-year-old who we kind of always thought was just more of a hardcourt player to beat. So huge credit to Cece. So those are the two teens, I feel like, at this point, because all these teenagers, they keep turning 20 because we can't even call Ostapenko a teen anymore. But yes, those two, Vondrousheva and Bellis, they seem to be, you know, making their mark on the 2017 tennis season, which is a very exciting thing.
For sure. I mean, the only other player I would mention, which I feel like we're kind of remiss in not mentioning her more, would be our number one, Angelique Kerber. You know, it's tough to really prognosticate her form because it's been so tough over the last few months on clay, but is a former Wimbledon finalist, is certainly comfortable on grass. And if you're going to lean heavy on past performances, you'd certainly have to put her among the top 12, top 14 in terms of players who can really turn things around at Wimbledon. I think it's going to be an important stretch of the season for Angie. And so all eyes will certainly be on her. And how she pulls up at this juncture of her career.
Yeah, it's a very good call with Kerber. I mean, we know she can turn it around. We know the quality that can come off her racket. Unfortunately, she had to pull out of Birmingham this week due to a leg injury. So hopefully that gets all sorted before Wimbledon. But look, the field on grass, because it is a surface that so many players are not particularly comfortable on, that we don't really have too many top-ranked grass court specialists. I mean, if you take Venus aside, you know, when you talk about someone who's just like, you know, they're going to do good on grass, I mean, that group is quite small in terms of being proven, because even a Karolina Pliskova, who we know has the game for it, has still never made it past the third round at Wimbledon. So she has to still break that duck. But there's not a ton that do well on the surface.
I mean, because the season is so short, for the most part, if you're successful on grass, you're pretty good on other surfaces. Otherwise, it'd be a pretty short year for you if you were only peaking in this 1 month of the year. Not to talk about Svetlana Parankova like she's not here. But
always we're talking about Svetlana Parankova. Parankova and Rybarikova.
Yes. But at the end of the day, I think, you know, what we were talking about offline, I think it bears repeating. It's just the fact that this was a hard list to put together, because it really was, for all the talk of it being anyone's title to win, at the end of the day, there really are only 12 or so players who we could really confidently assert, based on the numbers, as being capable of lifting these trophies at the end of the week. And so I think it is important to not get too lost in the numbers or too lost in the narrative or lost in the rankings, and really focus on this key group of players, because I really do think that if not at Wimbledon, certainly through the US Open, these are the impact players to watch. And these are the ones that are going to probably be featured in the latter stages of the biggest tournaments.
So much of trying to understand what's going on the tour these days is basically trying to balance the idea of, on any given day, regardless of whether it's a first round match or a final, regardless of whether we're talking about an international level tournament or a Grand Slam, on any given day, anyone can beat anyone. But over the course of time, looking at the past data of the last six months, even go even further than that, look at how the last year ended. On final Sunday, on final Saturday, as much as there may be surprises or chaos in the opening days of a tournament, or maybe the first week of a slam, that by the end, things kind of rectify themselves. That at the end, the veterans, the quality shines through. And I don't mean veterans and quality to be interchangeable. I mean, you look at Ostapenko, I mean, what she was able to do, but we knew what her quality was. And I think that most people who went into that final at the French Open who knew women's tennis knew that was a 50-50 match, that we knew that Ostapenko could get hot. So is it a surprise that she's in the final? Absolutely. Is it a surprise she won the final? Not at all. And that's kind of the weird balance that I find myself trying to strike all the time, which is that there aren't necessarily results. There are results that daily surprise me, but at the end of the day, tournaments seem to kind of work themselves out in the end.
And that's a wrap on this episode of the WTA Insider Podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, or on any podcast app of your choice to ensure you never miss an episode when they go live. Reviews are always helpful, so if you like what you've heard so far, please do leave us one. And you can get new episode alerts by following us on Twitter at WTA_insider. And we'll, of course, post the podcast on the WTA website at WTATennis.com. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.